Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your hosts, Drew Tignanelli and Tim Maurer.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. TJ's in the house. TJ, how are you?
Happy to be here, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well.
You know, it feels like we're starting to head into that one time of the year in Baltimore where, from a temperature perspective, you love to be here, right? Some of that crispness starting to come into the air. I know you'd prefer it just to be 95 and humid every day, but I like some of these temperatures we're getting
now. I don't mind anything that's not cold.
That's the thing that you... Well,
cold is not good.
And thankfully, Under Armour has created, you know, a...
Cold gear,
a
right.
system for
that's
you.
Right. And it works very well. Anyway, Tim, we got a guest tonight, but before we have our guest, we wanted to do a quick Drew's Views.
Okay,
and
good.
The thing that I wanted to address tonight is that if you haven't quoted your property casualty insurance, either as an individual in 10 years, if you haven't quoted your property casualty insurance, your auto and your home,
right.
in the last 10 years with a few other carriers, ask around, you know, who's cheap, you know, as I said a few weeks ago, I thought, you know, Erie was a great company to quote in this area in Maryland. Also, Amica Mutual is a great company to quote. And if you're a military, especially an officer, USAA is a great company to quote.
Fantastic.
You're going to lose a lot of money. Well, now I'm going to address business owners. Business owners, every year when your policy comes up for renewal, you should put that policy in competition. And that does not mean that you go to the agent that you're using. So let's say you're using XYZ insurance agency, and then they go out and say, okay, few companies give me bids here, and then they come back and
right.
say, hey, this is the best policy. No, that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, what are you talking
have
about?
You got to have two separate distinct agencies quoting that policy.
You want them battling for the best pricing.
In commercial property casualty, it's a significant difference.
Yes.
See, in personal property casualty, all the rates are recorded with the insurance commissioner. So
relatively uniform.
They are what they are.
Yeah.
They can't, you know, if you go to Erie and they say, well, you know, and you say, well, you know, USAA is offering me this, Erie says, well, that's my rate,
yeah,
you know?
That's all I got.
Whereas commercial insurance, there's a little more latitude. And,
a little wiggle room.
A lot of wiggle room. And, you know, you'll be surprised when your policy goes in competition with other agencies, all of a sudden, the rates just happen to mysteriously come down more.
Alakazam, how about that?
And so if you're a business owner and you have not put your policy into competition with agencies, different agencies, XYZ over here, ABC over here, and they're going out to other companies and trying to come up with the best quote to come to you.
Yep.
And then you share each other and then see, you know, do you guys have another shot you want to give it
yeah,
to?
Yeah, right.
You might be surprised what happens.
Are you sure that's your best
quote? Anyway, what do we have tonight?
Tonight, Drew, we're not talking about property and casualty insurance, but we do have
Darn.
An exciting guest who's been with us before. Kathleen Burns Kingsbury is a wealth psychology expert, behavioral change specialist, and author of several books, including How to Give Financial Advice to Women. She is the founder of KBK Wealth Connection, a company dedicated to training, coaching, and consulting with financial services professionals, folks like us, Drew, to improve client communication, retention, and profitability. But tonight, Kathleen will be discussing with us her newest book, which I'm not sure if it's out today or if it's going to be a couple of weeks. Kathleen will probably tell us that. Kathleen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tim, for having me, and it's nice to reconnect with you, Drew, as well.
Thank you.
So, Kathleen, is the new book available for sale right now?
It is. It's available on Amazon, and it went from pre-order to order just last week.
Wow, congratulations.
The official release date is next week, but somehow Amazon always gets their hands on things a little bit early. So,
and so it seems to work.
It's officially out.
So talk to us. What is the title, and what is the concept?
Sure. The title is How to Give Financial Advice to Couples, Essential Skills for Balancing High Net Worth Client Needs. And the concept came out of my first book, actually, the book about how to give financial advice to women. I was traveling around the country and talking to financial advisors and clients about that book, and time and time again they'd ask me questions about, well, what do I do if she's in the room with her partner, or how do I handle it if she's not interested in money but he is, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't take too many times where you hit me over the head and I go, wait a second, I think there's a need in the market for me to also be talking about couples and couples dynamics and money. So it was a fun project, and it's just wonderful to see it completed and to be able to be here and talking with you about it tonight.
So even though our show is to the general public and your book is about how financial advisors deal with couples, I guess your advice would be beneficial to everyone listening.
Absolutely. I mean, the book is specifically for advisors, but certainly every single one of us can probably relate at some point in time to being a member of a couple or being in a partnership, and how money at times can be stressful, it can be comical, and it can be something that you really need to kind of stay on top of and continue to discuss during the course of your relationship.
I thought you were just taking off on a motorcycle there, Kathleen.
I know. Wasn't that exciting?
Did you pick up on that, TJ?
I did, Drew. I was trying to figure out what type of motorcycle it was. But...
I'm sure you know.
Well,
I do all my radio interviews on a motorcycle.
It wasn't a Harley. I know that much. Kathleen, one of the statistics I saw regarding your book was that 70% of widows fire the financial advisor upon the passing of their husbands. Why is this dynamic the case?
I think the bottom line is that women don't feel like they have, for the most part, a good relationship with the financial advisor in general. And so often what ends up happening is, if she wasn't 100% crazy about the financial advisor she was working with, if her husband passes and all of a sudden she's managing the money solo, or at least solo for a period of time, she's going to say, do I want to continue to work with this person who was really somebody connected to my husband, or do I want to maybe find somebody who is a little bit more female friendly, or someone I feel more comfortable with, or maybe I want to, you know, meet with my daughter or son's financial advisor. So it's an opportunity to really, you know, it's a horrible opportunity, but an opportunity to look at, is this advisor meeting my needs? And more often than not, women are saying no.
You know, in 35 years, I can't think of a single widow that has ever left us. Because,
well, Drew, it's,
I think
because,
it's because
of your warm and fuzzy demeanor.
I don't know,
I think,
about that, Tim, but it's probably because we always work with the couple together.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've almost insisted on, is that both folks are involved, because we recognize more often than not the financial spouse in this relationship isn't the dude. It's the woman who oftentimes is the one really directing big financial decisions in the household anyway.
And that's why I really like, you know, certainly talking with you two, but I even was able to interview Tim for the book, and just, you know, having that philosophy of having both people in the room, I think, is really, really important. And I think all your listeners out there should think about, you know, do I do that? And if so, great. And if not, maybe I should consider making this a little bit more of a priority in my life, to take that hour or two, you know, every once in a while to meet with the financial advisor together.
Kathleen, we're going to be taking some time here momentarily to learn about the traffic situation in the Baltimore Metro. But when we come back, we'd love to talk more about your depth of understanding, inner working with couples and money, because that is something that all of us, whether we are financial advisors or anybody out there, we need to be thinking about this. But right now, we are going to go to Terry Troyer with traffic.
Radio 680 WCBM.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I guess Kristen couldn't think of anything.
Drew, don't give Kristen a hard time about the music again. Just because Kristen comes back with something that you might not know doesn't mean that it's not good. Kristen, just to give you an update, what Drew is familiar with is five bands, each of which are actually an animal. Okay, so Beatles, for example.
Well, let's move on, Tim.
Anyway.
Let's move on. So, Kathleen, well, one of my favorite books is Women Are From Pluto, Men Are From Earth. And I don't think
that's exactly the planet lineup,
no.
Drew, but yeah.
But there are differences between men and women. And so tell us some of what you think are the most significant differences between men and women.
I think when we're talking about men and women and money,
one of the most significant differences,
we're just trying to narrow it down a bit.
Just a little differences
has to do with how women tend to view wealth versus men.
Okay.
Women tend to define wealth and think about wealth in terms of security and freedom and also helping the next generation. And so we tend to, as a group, and there's always exceptions to the rule, but we tend to view it in a more holistic way than a lot of men do. If you look at the research around men and wealth and how they define it, they tend to think of things such as status, power, and control. And while I know those words can have negative connotations, I don't mean them to be negative. It's just really looking at money in a much more singular fashion and saying, you know, what can increased wealth do for me and, you know, my family or my status?
You're going to have to learn how to put those into a positive light.
Yeah,
because you put the women in a positive light.
Yes, they were couched in it and just a lovely. Here's
the
difference.
But I think she's right. Difference that I hang out every weekend with a bunch of guys and bike and ski and stuff.
Okay, all right.
Does that get me out of jail for free on that one?
Yeah.
Well, she's right, though.
She's absolutely right, Drew. We do. Guys tend to think of it, in fact, oftentimes in dollar denominations, it's almost like a competition for some guys, isn't it, Kathleen?
It can be. I mean, a lot of times what will happen is men will really, and you probably experience this in your practice, but men will really want to beat the market. And so they'll make some decisions or jump from a stock to a stock just trying to have that win, as opposed to women typically will take more time to make an investment, but then hang out for the long haul. And, you know, we joke about the differences in it being positive and negative, but one of the things that I talk about in the book, and I also talk about when I'm out speaking, is the idea that, you know, the male and female brain is a little bit different in terms of how it's structured, and you can actually trace some of this back to our neuroscience. So it's not just, you know, guys being one way and women being the other, that there's actual biology behind it, which is kind of fascinating.
It is fascinating. And one of the things I think that for a while, part of the issue maybe was that being a relatively paternalistic industry, right, to begin with, the financial services, and I know that's no secret to you, but the guys may have felt more comfortable communicating to other guys. So it was mostly guys who were giving the advice, and they weren't necessarily seeing it in the different ways that women will perceive these issues. So you think that's been one of the problems? And have you seen improvement in that regard where more women are actually playing the role of the advisor and broadening the horizons of the industry, therefore?
I do agree, and I actually look at the industry as, you know, it was a male industry created by men with a male brain, and so of course it's skewed towards men, but that's nobody's fault. If you look back in women's history, 100 years ago, we couldn't even own property. In the 1950s and 60s, it was very rare, the exception to the rule that we could even have our own credit card. So women have come a long way, and the industry, I think, is catching up now, but it kind of makes sense that that's how it historically has happened. The industry is still pretty much 20% female, 80% male, and I think that there's some really important shifts that are happening out there to welcome more females into the industry. But, you know, if you're thinking about clients, often what women clients look for, and I believe some men clients too, is that what we're looking for is somebody that we can trust, somebody that we feel like listens and hears us, and is able to talk not only numbers, but also kind of that holistic stuff of, you know, what are you feeling about it? What are your concerns? And then how do we develop a financial plan or an investment strategy to help you worry less or, you know, manage your risk tolerance, whatever the question might be for that client. So I don't believe that that is necessarily gender specific. I think a really good financial advisor can do that for either a man or a woman. And I think the field is definitely moving in that direction.
Do you think that that there's a difference between how men and women spend money? I mean, I remember Larry Burkett once said, he said, women spend $2,000, $5 at a time. Men spend $2,000 in one big shot.
Well, what you're probably referencing has to do with the fact that women tend to shop differently than men. So there are, you know, like I said, there's always exceptions to the rule. But in general, women are gatherers. So we tend to shop for a social experience. We tend to go into a store, and we kind of gather things. We might go for one item and end up with 10. Men tend to shop like hunters, where you will go in, you will see your purchase, you will shoot it between the eyes, kill it, bag it, and bring it home.
See, so again, said that in
that
a negative way.
Purchase.
No, that was a positive. That was a positive way to say it, Drew. Kathleen, I may have told you this story before, but when my wife and I got married, she had visions. You know, you don't know exactly how this whole thing's going to work out on a day-to-day basis, but we each probably had a vision of how that would function. And I recall the first time we went to the grocery store together, and we got there, and she's like, "Yeah, this will be great. It'll be a weekly type of rhythm that we can get into as a couple, some quality time." We got into the grocery store. I said, "Where's the list?" She handed it to me. I ripped it in half. I said, "All right, I'll meet you in the middle." And it was nothing like the idea that she had in mind. And I think this hunter-gatherer thing, there is something to it, Drew.
I know our associate Mike McCarthy would take that as a positive.
Yeah, of course.
Going in, shoot it between the eyes,
and bring it
home. He killed 60 doves this weekend. He thought that was the greatest.
How many women share the size of their television with other women? You know what I mean? And they're like, "Yeah, just got a 55-inch. No, I got a 75-inch television." You know what I mean? How many women even know how many inches their television is? But it's very, very interesting dynamic, Kathleen, that we see playing out. One of the things I'd like to get into here for a couple of minutes and then again later is, what are some of the more divisive issues that couples face, and then some of the ways that they can get over them? Say, like, how do we get over financial conflicts when the husband thinks one way and the wife thinks another?
Well, I think the biggest mistake that couples make is that we fight about the particular purchase or the particular investment, and we really dig our heels in. And this is not gender specific necessarily, but we dig our heels in and think our way is the right way. And what I talk about, and I think you do this in your work as well, Tim, is really about getting to what's underneath that. What's the money belief or the thought that's leading you to think that purchase or investment makes sense? And then here's the hard part: stepping out of your own money mindset and kind of exploring what your partner's thoughts and feelings are. But we can certainly talk a little bit more about that in detail if you like, but I think that's the biggest mistake. It's not one particular fight. It's a series of fights that comes back to having somewhat different beliefs about money.
Do you find, Kathleen, that there are deeper root issues than just the pure economics of finances between husband and wife?
I think it depends on the couple. There are certainly many couples out there that from time to time argue or disagree about money, and there's not some deep, dark, clinical issue going on where the marriage needs to split. I also think that there is a small percentage of folks that are out there that probably end up in a financial advisor's office instead of a therapist's office, arguing about money, vying for power and control in a disruptive way where it really is a reflection of something going on. Maybe it's a reflection of lack of trust or lack of respect or control.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think all money problems are deeper issues, but I do think there are some that do require a different type of treatment than, you know, talking with a financial advisor.
You know, that's how our mission statement came about: the help lessen the worry and burden of money management so you can focus on something more important in life, like relationships, is because we came to the realization one day that we have a lot of couples that come to see us. And what they're really coming to see us about is, if you can help us get our finances in better order, our marriage will probably be happier.
Hmm.
I do believe that when you communicate openly about money, there's a lot that's underneath that in terms of values and open communication that really does increase intimacy. So I don't think that it can ever be a bad thing, but I don't always think it's a sign of something really horrible going wrong.
Yeah, sure. That's true.
Sure. But with the statistics just bearing out the number of divorces that take place and the number or percentage of divorces that take place as a result of financial issues, it does seem that if good financial advisors can help get some of those financial issues off the table and offer clarity, if there aren't deeper clinical issues within the marriage, hopefully that would keep them out of harm's way in some cases.
Absolutely. I do agree there. I think that there's a huge opportunity and a really I think if couples could learn to talk more openly about money, we'd be better off in a variety of levels, not only in terms of our relationship, but as a society.
Well, Kathleen, you got to hold on with us. We're going to find out what's happening with traffic right now, Terry Troy, and we're going to come back with more of Kathleen Burns Kingberry and find out how couples can communicate with money. This is Money, Rich, and Wealth. And take it away, Terry.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
There you go, Tim. See?
She's paying attention,
Drew. She's paying. It's an animal.
It is an animal.
And it deals with love and couples, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Really hit the nail on the head there.
All right.
Noah, one of Drew's top ten.
Noah, you don't have to come back. Oh, don't let him know that.
Don't tell him we said that.
He'd be hurt. Anyway, we're here with Kathleen Burns Kingberry. We're talking about two books, right? Women and Money and so forth, Couples and Money. But what I wanted to ask is back to the women and money,
yep.
And that is the widow, because I'll bet you, you know, there are a lot of women listeners to our radio show.
There are.
And I bet you there are a few widows out there. So what is it, Kathleen, with the widow that is probably one of their biggest financial concerns? Let's just say in the first year. I mean, obviously, that's a difficult time. What are the things they should be thinking about doing, not doing, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. I think the first thing that a widow needs to do is give herself some time to grieve. And hopefully she has somebody already in her corner, her financial corner, that can help her decide what to take care of first, second, and third. I mean, you guys know this better than I do. There's certain things in the short term, like insurance, Social Security, if that is part of the picture, getting death certificates, filing certain types of information is necessary. And then there's a lot of stuff that isn't necessary. I think one of the biggest mistakes that I see widows make is that because they are grieving and going and experiencing that loss and that, you know, mixed emotion from anger to sadness to maybe relief if they were a primary caregiver, what ends up happening is sometimes they make some rash financial decisions. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to sell the house and relocate. And really, I encourage people to take 6 months to a year before you make those types of decisions, because often they're emotionally based. They're not based on something that's going to actually be true for you in the long term once you're able to get through some of the initial stages of grief. I think the other thing that widows need to be really careful of, and I really wish this was not true, but it is, there are a lot of people out there who look for widows who maybe have inherited some money, who maybe don't have the financial expertise or knowledge, are a little bit naive. This is not every widow, but there are some out there. And there are men who will try to date them, and there will be unscrupulous financial advisors who will try to take advantage of them. So that's why I think it's really important to have a trusted financial advisor well before something like that happens, to just make sure who you're going to you can trust, and they can help you discern what to take care of now versus what to put off for 6 months to a year, because a lot of decisions don't need to be made right away.
I had a situation in the 1990s where I had a couple that I worked with, and the husband was clearly the financial spouse. He did all kinds of things. He had investments all over the place. Mm-hmm. I had probably 7 different custodians, annuities, mutual funds, brokerage accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And he had an account with us, mm-hmm. or with me, and there was a fair amount of money in there. But when he passed away, the spouse, who also we had met with, she knew me, she trusted me, she came to me and said, well, what do I do? And it took us about a year to get everything into order that we could start helping her with them.
Wow.
And after that, I said, I've got to develop a service that the financial spouse can do all the things they want to do, but under our auspices to some degree, make it as cost effective for them as possible, so that if they pass away or become unable to handle the money, I can just flip a switch and that non-financial spouse can come to us and we can help them immediately to manage that money.
And I think that speaks to why couples really need to be having these conversations. It's not, both people don't have to really love finance and love investments, but they do need to know kind of where things are, or at least have someone like you, Tim, who's going to help them know where things are located. So, you know, God forbid something like a sudden death happens, you have a lot of things to take care of. So trying to find accounts may be the last on your list.
Kathleen, I've got a question for you that I'm sure you hear all the time. And this one is going more toward the dynamics of working with couples in their own finances, separate or joint accounts. Now, sometimes we have estate planning reasons to be splitting up accounts and having differing names owned by trust, possibly. But I'm just talking about managing cash inflow and outflow. What are your thoughts on having joint or separate checking and savings accounts?
Great question. And I really think it is up to the couple, as long as the couple makes it a well-informed decision. And by that, you've already mentioned some instances where it might make sense to have separate accounts, right? Say you have a blended family, there's, you know, stepkids, there's kids from the new union, it gets kind of complicated. You really want to sit down and think about financially what makes the most sense, and then to run a household, what makes the most sense. If you look at younger couples, what's happening more and more, especially as women's economic power increases, meaning that they have more of their own wealth, what's happening more often is younger couples are coming in the door, both established in their careers, so they may have some separate money, and as they decide to cohabitate or get married, they combine that money together.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's important is that everybody knows what the structure is and at least agrees why it's happening the way it's happening. I know in my marriage, one of the things we agreed upon is that we would have everything in a joint account, except each of us has access to our own individual account for daily spending. And I encourage couples, we don't do this in my couplehood, I think the number would be higher than this, but I encourage couples that I work with to come up with a dollar amount.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much can he or she spend before he or she needs to have a conversation with you? And by default in my couplehood, it's probably $500. I know another couple that I interviewed for this new book, and it was $75. So the amount doesn't matter so much as long as you both agree on it, but it's really having an understanding of we can have some privacy around money. That's different than secrecy. We can have some privacy control, and sometimes individual accounts give that, but then we're also going to manage our lives together. Once again, ultimately up to the couple, and certainly when it comes to same-sex couples, often they are less commingled than heterosexual couples by the nature of how their couplehood evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen, you have to hold on for us for a moment because Timothy is going to tell us something we need to know. Timothy, what is it?
Drew, I would be glad to accommodate that request as usual. You need to know the only surefire way to avoid being haunted by Facebook. We've known for a while now that employers are scanning the social media presence of would-be employees before making an offer. Last week, we also learned that our very own credit worthiness could be impacted, not only by the content we put forth, but also by the knuckleheadedness of those to whom we are connected online. So unless you decide to follow my personal path, Facebook abstinence, the only method proven scientifically effective in 100% of cases, I hereby offer the only slightly less certain way to avoid being haunted by your social media past. Don't say stupid stuff online. Consider this litmus test to be applied before liking, updating, tweeting, sharing, tumbling, or plussing. Only share that which you would be happy to see appearing in bold caps on the front page of USA Today, the New York Times, and your hometown paper. Regardless of whether we are looking up old schoolmates on Facebook, scanning for trends on Twitter, building our virtual networks on LinkedIn, or applying for a loan, it is up to us to determine what information in our possession is worthy of dissemination in these online venues. While it seems that every third person we meet these days is a social media consultant, quote-unquote, the affirmation litmus test for online activity won't cost you an awkward lunch meeting and is simply based on applying the 2,400-year-old Hippocratic Oath to ourselves. First, do no harm. Whether we like it or not, we may need to consider protecting our social media footprint the way we protect our credit score, for the sake of our available credit, our employment, and even our reputation with family, friends, and colleagues. As Will Rogers said well before Al Gore invented the Internet, it takes a lifetime to build a good reputation, but you can lose it in a minute. The advent of social media has given us the opportunity to fast-track reputation building, but it has also shortened the journey to embarrassment and magnified every online misstep. So unless you're willing to see that post, tweet, status update, or email making headline news, you should probably hit delete instead of send. And that is something you need to know.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
She got one right.
Well, Drew, look, it's one of my favorite Beatles songs. I think Kristen assumed...
I liked it when I was a kid.
Now he's an old guy, Kristen. He likes to tone it down a little bit. No screaming in Drew's music these days. Sorry, Drew.
Kathleen, you know...
You know, you're not that old.
Kathleen, you know...
Yes.
Can you just...
Stop talking for
there
a minute?
There you go. Kathleen, see, you gotta have the third book out. How to have financial advice for radio hosts and co-hosts.
How to talk about music on the radio.
There you go. We could use that. We could use a little help here. Anyway, what was I thinking about? I was thinking about this. The conversation for couples, I'm going to assume, and you're going to tell me whether I'm right or wrong, is going to be different for a 30-year-old couple, for a 40-year-old couple that's been married for 15 years and has two children, and a 65-year-old couple whose second marriage and blended family, et cetera, et cetera, and et cetera.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that couples have a lifespan and a life cycle. So, you know, if you're just meeting and you're a new couple but you're in your 50s, that conversation's going to look a little bit different than if you're just meeting in your 20s. In fact, if you're just meeting in your 20s, you'd be lucky if you had a money conversation. That would be great, but often that doesn't happen. And so I really think what couples need to do is find time to sit down and have a money conversation, which isn't always easy to do in our society, which is busy and doesn't believe in talking about money openly, but to sit down and have a money conversation about, you know, what's going on in our lives financially. Where do we want to be? Where are we right now? And to really focus that conversation much more on what your thoughts and beliefs are as opposed to pointing a finger or telling your partner what they're doing wrong. In fact, I just heard from a friend today that over the weekend her husband sat her down and gave her a spreadsheet and told her she needed to fill it out during the week because her spending was too high. And that's not a strategy that's going to work long term because
you couldn't be kidding. I've been doing it for 20 years. She hasn't filled it out once. I'm still hoping.
Well, that's
still waiting.
You can make the request.
But she hasn't left me.
You've softened up a good more than that, Drew. Yeah, no, it's a great point. And one of the things, Kathleen, that I've found is that we have a tendency to demonize our spouse based on the way that they handle money. Of course, not recognizing that the way they handle money may have been largely driven by their upbringing and their own life experiences, but we have a tendency to demonize each other personally. So my wife might think that I'm stingy, and I might think that she can be wasteful from time to time, when in fact it's not that either of us have necessarily a character flaw. It's just based on our own personal experience and our comfort level. Is that right?
Yes, and also what you're speaking to is the fact of the matter that most of the times we've developed our thoughts and beliefs about money in our childhood using a child's mind.
Right.
So notice when we're thinking about our spouse, and especially if we're emotional about money, we do tend to use these black and white terms and calling each other names like we're five-year-olds, when indeed we're in our 40s. And so part of that just has to do with the fact that we haven't learned how to talk as adults about money. And there is no right or wrong, there's just differences. And chances are, you ended up with your partner because they compliment you in some way. I mean, I used to get so angry because my husband would pick up the tab for everybody in the bar or at the restaurant. And then later I figured out, you know, part of what attracted me to him was his generosity. And clearly I was the spreadsheet girl, which I think helped him.
So you're talking about taking a look, a closer look, at the traits that we may even deem not ideal and look for the good in them. That's fascinating.
The question I always have people ask is, what is the gift? What is the gift of that behavior? And it's sometimes hard to ask of ourselves, but it's even more challenging sometimes to look at our partner and go, you know what, that behavior drives me crazy, but there's a reason that I'm here with you in this dynamic. And so what is the gift of that behavior? And there's certainly a lot of gifts about his spontaneity, and I gave him gifts around my stinginess, to use your word.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite couples conversations was a couple came to see us to do retirement planning, and first question I ask him is, okay, what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve? When do you want to retire? What do you want to do? So the husband starts talking. He says, well, in 2 years, we're going to retire. And when we retire, about 6 months later, we're going to sell our house in Maryland. We're going to move to Florida. You know, and he's going on and on. And as he's talking, the wife's eyes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. This is the first time she ever heard their financial goals in life.
That's amazing.
And so we had to bring the conversation back around.
But that's what you're speaking to is exactly why people need to meet with folks like you and need to have these conversations, because often in our head it makes total sense and we think we've shared it with our partner, only to discover, wow, I guess I never told you that, or that's my plan, what's your plan? And a lot of couples disagree about that next stage of life, and it's not about having to be absolutely on the same page. It's about really being able to understand where the other person is coming from and to try to work at something where you can appreciate and value each person's different perspective.
Absolutely.
Before the show is over, I want to know when we're going out to dinner with Kathleen's husband.
Oh, that's a good point.
Because he's going to pick up the tab.
Yeah.
He'll pick up the check.
Yeah.
So pick a really expensive place, Tim.
Just let us know when you guys are coming through Baltimore next time, Kathleen. We'd love to get together. Kathleen, although the trend is clearly going in the direction of dual-income households, the cost of living has gone up, and the trends just seem to be pointing that way, there's still an awful lot of folks who have a stay-at-home spouse. And I'm curious, how can a stay-at-home spouse be given some more financial independence within that context?
Well, I think there's a couple of ideas. I mean, one thing to just know is sometimes if you're in a traditional home like that, sometimes it is agreeable to both partners to let the person who is the primary breadwinner, the husband, manage the money and, you know, take care of that part of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It is okay if there's a power differential if both the members of the couple agree.
Okay.
I think for women who are in that situation who are not feeling empowered,
mm-hmm.
one of the things they might do is sit down with their husband and talk about, is there a way in which they could either draw a salary? I know that that's probably not the best use of terms, but draw a salary or be able to be compensated for the work that they do around the house.
Sure.
And really, it's a team effort. She's helping him be successful at work by taking care of the home and the
sure.
kids. And so coming up with some sort of agreement that feels peer-to-peer, I think the dilemma or the tricky part is making sure it doesn't get into an adult-child situation where one person is telling the other person what to do and then they get scolded.
Yeah.
So really having that peer-to-peer conversation about how can we both be empowered even if you are the primary breadwinner. And the beauty of working with couples and working with clients is often they come up with really creative solutions that we haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Kathleen, we're coming close to the end of our time here. It's amazing that it's gone so quickly as it always does. But would you first give folks an idea of how they can come upon your work, your books and your work online, and then also maybe leave us with a final word?
Sure. My company is KBK Wealth Connection. The best way to reach me is go to my website, which is kbkwealthconnection.com. The book that is new and out is How to Give Financial Advice to Couples, and also How to Give Financial Advice to Women is on the website as well. In terms of reaching out, I mean, think of me for speaking engagements, for consultations, and for just helping couples have clarity around money. And a final word, that feels like a lot of pressure. I feel like I just want to jump on my motorcycle and speed off.
Again,
it could be musically oriented too, of course.
Yes. I think that my final word for couples and money is to really sit down and think about, here's a person I'm spending my life with, and money is often a complicated topic, but how can we spend 10, 15 minutes a week learning about each other's thoughts and beliefs about money? And to start with the question, what is your greatest financial success? And what did you learn from it? To really point it towards the positive. And I think if we make the time that we make to watch movies, to take care of our kids, you know, to have intimate times, to take 15 or 20 minutes to talk about money.
Good to go. Thanks,
Kathleen.
That's great.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
It's Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.